Today on the broadcast, we'll hear from Senator and Vice Presidential candidate Tim Kaine, the first Virginian on a major party's presidential ticket since Woodrow Wilson. Speaking of the election, tonight's the first presidential debate with many voters dissatisfied with their options. Among them is 2nd District Congressman Scott Ridgel, who joins us today. Congressman Ridgel is getting ready to leave the House of Representatives, and we'll ask him to reflect on his time in office and take your questions. We'll get to it all after this news from NPR. Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. Good to have you with us today. We have a great show for you today. A little bit later in the broadcast, we'll hear from Senator Tim Kaine. He, of course, is the Democratic candidate for vice president on Hillary Clinton's ticket, and we'll talk with him about what that surreal experience has been like as he has been in the national campaign. We'll also have some thoughts on tonight's upcoming debate. I don't know about you. I'm surprised that any of us are able to function for the rest of the day with all the excitement about the debate. That sarcasm, my friends. If you watch any of the coverage of this thing, which, by the way, has been going on for at least 72 hours at the site of the debate, wow, you just have to be a little concerned for the Republic. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. But a reminder that our coverage of the debate this evening gets underway at 9 o'clock. It'll be broadcast right here on WHRV as well as on WHRO-TV. So something to add to your viewing schedule just a little bit later. We are glad to have with us today as well Congressman Scott Ridgel. He's been a good friend of this broadcast, and he is getting ready to leave the House of Representatives, and we're awfully glad to be having him in the conversation today. Congressman Ridgel, are you there?
I am, and I appreciate the opportunity, Kathy.
Yeah.
I always enjoy our conversation.
As do I. I think we have talked often on this broadcast about our thirst for a greater civility in our public discourse, and I have always appreciated your thoughts on that. But you are getting ready to pack it up there in Washington, D.C., having served and made a decision that says I'm pretty well finished. What is that experience like at this point as you're getting to the end of it?
Well, it's reflective, and I think you can understand that. It's been it will be a 7.5-year journey for my family and for me, a year and a half of seeking office and then 6 years of serving. And for example, today I had the privilege of presiding over the House floor from, well, I think, 2 to 3 today. And I'm taking more opportunities like that just to soak it up, just to recognize what a privilege it is to serve, not only in the House of Representatives, but specifically Virginia's 2nd Congressional District. It is very special. I'm glad that I served. The 6 years in some ways went quickly. I think I've been tempered by this experience. My family has been tested. It's been challenging and demanding, and parts of it quite difficult. But it's an honor to serve. I'm glad that I had this opportunity. We're still and remain a very, very special country, and
yeah.
This is a special place.
When you say you've been, when you say there have been moments that have been really challenging and difficult, and moments of great privilege, I wonder if you'd give us an example of each. I know you've really tried hard to carry forward debate on fiscal issues about
right.
which you are greatly concerned.
Well, the number one challenge that comes to mind, Kathy, when you ask that question is, just the different buckets of life, trying to be, keep your family, first, so you don't get off the rails on that. And then be an effective member of Congress. And then to be up here, you have to get elected. And so you got to spend time in the district. And then also, it has to be said, to raise the funds needed to win in a competitive district like ours. And so if you think of them as buckets of life, I found it difficult, and I suppose all of us do to some extent in life, keeping all of them in proper balance. It's like, give me three out of the four, I can do that. I can't do four out of the four, and that was challenging. There have been moments where I've said, you know, a member, just a regular person, and I think of myself as such, a person who kind of put down, figuratively speaking, my plow, and then came up here to serve, and you really can make a difference. I remember vividly being in the Situation Room there at the White House, looking and having a conversation with Vice President Biden about my effort to have the president seek and receive authorization for the use of military force in Syria. And, I mean, he knew about our effort, frankly, which was the effort in the House, the definitive effort to get the president to do that, and in partnership with Barbara Lee from California. And I've had other moments, you know, where you're in the speaker's office, just the two of you, speaking directly to the leader of the House of Representatives, and you can do so candidly, and he listens, and that's both under Ryan and Boehner. Mm. And so there are times, and even like this afternoon, just presiding over the House floor, where when I walk on the floor, I try not to take it for granted. I really don't.
So, it's an enormous privilege, no question about it. We're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Those are the numbers where you can join us to talk with retiring Congressman Scott Ridgel. He will be leaving when his term is up and a new person is elected, and we'd love to hear from you, particularly if you live in the second. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. We're going to get to some policy issues in the course of our conversation, but I'm sure you started to say, well, of course, we're all painfully aware that there is this presidential election coming up that feels like it's been underway for about 40 years, but in fact, it's only been four. You know, I wonder what you make of this moment in our country, because you are the first Republican who said, I cannot support the party's nominee. You've come out and supported Gary Johnson. How did you come to that decision, and what has that been like since you announced that?
It was a very, very difficult one, and in some sense, as an adult who's, you know, had traditional experiences of raising children, family, good things, rough things in life. At 56 years old, it never. I never could have imagined that I'd be in this position. I just never believed that Donald Trump would rise to the top. And at first, it didn't really seem to matter. But the caustic message, and for me as a fiscal conservative, and I just really don't know who he is and what he truly believes. And I really wrestled with this greatly. But at the end of the day, I think what a man or woman needs to have is a clear conscience, to the extent that we all make mistakes in life. But I could not proactively vote for and elevate an individual who I think would be reckless, particularly with foreign policy. And I also objected outright and categorically on the way in which he's demeaned people, and just he has insulted him his way to the nomination, and that really bothers me. And I have to say in the same sentence that for character issues, principally, and others issues, notably policy on spending and taxation, I am not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. So I mean, it's not. Some can't vote for Trump, will vote for a secretary. I can't do that. And so for me, I evaluated the third alternative, who's on all 50 ballots. And I like Gary Johnson. We don't agree on everything, but he's a good man. I mean, he's a two-term governor of New Mexico, great record on fiscal issues, and I'm all in. So my conscience will be clear on election day.
And I hear your conscience will be clear, but this was a tough pill for folks that you've been close to in the Republican Party. I mean, I wonder what that was like when you announced this.
Well, some understood, and some didn't.
Yeah.
And everywhere I go, I'm engaged on this at one level or another. And a lot of people are very supportive. Others are very adamant. And some joke around about it, but some are very serious with it. I actually deactivated my campaign Facebook page. I just didn't see any purpose in it. And it because it just really got rough. And I'm not afraid of the criticism. And I have no remorse over my decision, nor am I gleeful about it. Or, I'm not indifferent to how others view this. But I have to have a clear conscience. And I think that's true, I trust, of every person who goes into a voting booth.
Sure.
And I think I needed to say something as a... I wrestle with just not, well, maybe I should just not say anything. But I think if we have any hope of, we have to have some boundaries within our Republican Party. And I felt like I and others were planting a flag of there are boundaries here that you don't cross. And if you do, you are not going to be elevated in our party. And obviously... that didn't happen.
16 minutes past the hour. Congressman Scott Ridgel joining us today. And you can join us as well at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Congressman Ridgel, we have talked many times over the years about your concerns about the fiscal house in the United States of America and the need for a budget. And in fact, one of our listeners, Jim, wants to know whether that remains a goal for you in your waning days in office. And he's very concerned about that as well.
Well, he has a basis for that, and it's a bipartisan. I don't know where he is on the political continuum. It does not matter to me because we're all in this together. Anchorage, Alaska, to Key West, Florida, any demographic group you want to mention, we're all in this together. And I am going to continue to work on this even after I get out of office. But I see it as the number one imperative, and I'm going to share this with our conference again, our Republican conference, and sometime on the House floor to speak about the need for this. And not to get in the weeds on it, but I really believe that the hyper gerrymandered districts that we have in our country have really hurt us on this. Only about 8% of congressional seats in this election cycle are competitive, 8%. And that means 92 are they're coming back. And the easiest way for a Republican to come back, and this is a generalization, is to say, no, just vote no on anything that looks like a bipartisan compromise. And same is true on the Democratic side. If they make any thoughtful, meaningful, and needed reforms to mandatory spending, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, they are at risk of not getting their nomination. And so...
So it's all over the place.
Oh, it's on both. It truly is. Now, it truly is. And this idea that one party is, you know, the keeper of all truth, and one party is, you know, taking America down. I am in firm disagreement with my Democratic friends on spending, and I have seen what I know now is an irrefutable truth. So far as I see it, they come to the floor, they want to spend more, and they want to grow government. And people might take offense to that generalization, but it is what I've experienced.
But you've also had conversations. And this is what I think is so interesting about this is that, and I think you just said this to some extent, you know, if there is an effort to dial it back or to make substantive proposals, that there is not an environment where those can be aired in the light of day, if that makes sense.
No,
those are
right.
Side and conversations.
That's right. And there are so many things that pop up. And the media drives, and I'm not saying they shouldn't, but things that come up that require our attention and distract us from some of these larger underlying issues like the fiscal situation. And that's a real challenge because, you know, what the president is doing with respect to internet domain names and things like that, these are serious issues.
Mm-hmm.
But this underlying issue of our fiscal house that we're all in this, and I would say it's not exactly how much we owe, but how much we owe relative to our economy. And that's one point I'm trying to make, is that it's the ratio there. It's the relative size of our debt to our economy. I'd like to have no debt, but we could handle some debt if it was lower than it is now.
Mark's on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Mark. You're on the air with Congressman Ridgel.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, good. How you doing, Congressman?
Thank you.
Good. I just want to let you know I'm with you on that. Gary Johnson is going to be my candidate because I don't know whether or not if Jill Stein is going to make it. And the very point that you're stepping up is a sign of true leadership. Because I always say that it's always easy to follow the other 8 or 9, but it's the person who's self-confident that can go in the opposite direction and set a new tone. That's true leadership. And I just thank you so much for, pronouncing it, because the media has failed us. Because the fact of the matter, and I've said it a million times, is that there are 5 candidates running for the presidency. And the media, they always want to loot the 2 candidates. And that couldn't be more inaccurate from the truth. And so if more people like you, the true leadership, would get in front of this, I think we can just turn around the whole paradigm shift to where we can actually have more than just a traditional 2-party system.
Well, appreciate and I'm humbled by your comments. And I do think that the 2 parties need to be shocked they need to have a true competitive threat, competitive in the sense that another party's winning over the hearts and the minds and ultimately the votes of the American people, because I think that's the only way that they're going to change. And so I see the Libertarian Party, although I'm not a Libertarian per se, I still, if you put the 3 platforms up and say, oh, I'm this one over here, the fiscal conservative, that's who I am. I am a Republican, at least in my core values. But I think a stronger Libertarian Party, and I am going to vote for Gary Johnson, Governor Johnson. I think this is going to be good for our country. It's better than this path that we're on, because, see, one of the things that is going to be taken away from this election, whether Trump wins or not, is any objective person, whether consciously or unconsciously, who's running for presidency can say, well, how'd the last guy get it?
Mm.
And now he's kind of a unique fellow, but still that basic caustic approach is going to be reviewed, and people are going to say, well, that's what got this guy to the top.
Mark, thank you for the call. Diane is
thank
on the
Mark.
Line from Hampton. Hi, Diane. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
Hi, fine, thanks.
Hi,
Brian.
Diane.
I felt so encouraged hearing you talk, because I've been a lifelong Republican. I stuffed envelopes for Richard Nixon at the age of 16.
All right.
So you can tell how old I am. But I've had the same feelings that first of all, that I can't vote for either one of these candidates. And in the second place, that while I'm not 100% in Gary Johnson's column as far as everything he believes, at least he is a civil gentleman who will talk about issues. And I think we need that. If we can't get to the point where the 2 parties or 3 parties can talk to one another, then what are we doing?
Diane, thanks for the call.
Thank
ahead,
you, Diane. And let me take this to the highest level possible. This last Sunday, a week ago Sunday, that I had the privilege of speaking to a Gold Star community, Gold Star, those who had given their family member, given their life and service to our country. And I was very humbled to be there. And because of the commands in our district, we have a disproportionate loss. And I make the point in reflecting on this, that if you look at Arlington, there are no Democratic tombstones and no Republican tombstones. And most young people there who lay in rest there didn't even know anything about all of that. And I make the point that we are first and foremost fellow Americans, and that idea that they're deserved, Democrats have fought and died for this country. Republicans have fought and died for this country. Those who had made up their mind, had fought, and you know, ethnicity, et cetera. And so I approached my Democratic friends with a basic sense of, you have a seat at the table. Doesn't mean I agree with you, and we are going to debate the issues and try to elevate the facts and let the facts lead us somewhere. But I just can't buy into this, the demeaning of a person or even questioning patriotism or something. I might question wisdom, and I do that a lot.
Or facts.
Or facts.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's another thing that good and reasonable people can really dig in on and sometimes disagree even on that.
Yeah, fair enough.
Or the best solution set.
Diane,
they're deserving of respect.
Diane, thank you for the call. I want to get back to this question about the budget, because Nancy asks a very interesting question. And just based on Nancy's posts over time, I am going to guess she is not a member of your party. I'm just going to guess that. But her question, I think, really points up where this conversation sometimes goes off the rails. She says, how does one cut spending while not enhancing revenue? And if I remember correctly, you've talked about enhancing revenue as well, and she talks about what she perceives to be wasteful military spending. It seems so much of the cuts are to the poor and elderly. So this is where we always come down to. So
let's
unpack that. Yeah.
Let's see if I can actually make this concise. I actually introduced, and I think it's the only piece of legislation that does this. It was America First, and it actually, in a meaningful but modest way, just slowed down the rate of growth in mandatory spending. It would still increase, just not as quickly. And I also had some tax revenue in there to help my Democratic friends. And because we are at a historically slightly lower rate of taxation as a percent of our economy than we have been. And that's what I try to make the point, is that if you hold the view that you will never vote for any increase in taxes under any scenario ever, well, then our Democratic friends, many of them say, well, I'm never going to vote for any reduction in mandatory spending ever. Well, then we're done. We are literally done as a country, because mathematically there is a day of reckoning, and it's not good. I mean, that's not black helicopter type talk. That's just fiscal reality. So I would say, with respect to the military spending, Nancy, that it is truly lower than it has been as a percent of our economy. It's quite low. I think 3.5%, something like that. It's been probably 4 or 5 historically. Is there some wasteful spending in there? Absolutely. But we are in a dangerous world, and we, a Democratic president under his leadership, has had our country engaged worldwide. We are engaged in countries that most people have no clue that we're in, and we are literally fighting wars in these countries in a very real way. And so our people and our equipment are tired, and the refurbishment that is needed, I get these reports. Some of them are classified, some of them aren't. But the overall idea that defense spending is the problem, that is just literally not true. What has exploded, and that's not a hyperbole type word, what has exploded and will continue to drive our fiscal situation is mandatory spending, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. And we have a duty to our seniors and those who can't help themselves, but we can navigate this. But we all have to move a bit.
And the revenue side of the house, though, this is interesting, because I'm trying to remember what the equation you said was. This has been some time ago, but it had to do with the amount of money we're raising in taxes,
right,
and the amount that we're spending. It sounded like something that some folks really liked and seemed to make some sense, but it was hard to get traction with it it addressed the issue that Nancy's talking about.
It's easy to dance around it and say, oh, Scott, I respect your leadership for putting that bill out. It was 137 pages, I think. And they say, oh, that I really, but, you know, I would have done this 0.5% more or something like that. And it was just a reason, I suppose, not to get on it. But let me give you this quick example, and I think it'll help the listeners, because I think education for all of us is a good thing. I'm trying to get educated in this and continue to, even though I've been studying it for this long. it's percent of our economy. And when Warren Buffett and I sat down, he said, I'm around 21% of revenue. And I said, well, Warren, I'm about 19%. I'd go down to 18 if I could and spending. And we said, but I said, you know, I could saddle up at 20. He said, I could saddle up. I could do 20. And we actually agreed. I mean, it would take Republicans coming up a little bit and Democrats coming down a little bit. But a kind of a 2020 vision, if you think about it, to use that analogy, a 2020 vision for America, revenue at around 20%, expenses at around 20%, and that's 20% of our gross domestic product. That's where we need to be. And if we were only different about a percent or so, that wouldn't be a big problem. We could handle that, but our deficits are greater than that, and this accumulated debt is way too high, and so we're a nation at risk because of it.
I so appreciate Nancy's question, because I think very often these we sort of think in absolute terms around this, and all of this is we can talk about it all. We have to have facts, and we have to have an opportunity to hear what people are saying, and all the rest of it. It's a very, very interesting exercise. Jason's on the line from Virginia Beach. Thanks for holding, Jason.
Hey, how you guys doing?
All right.
Hi, Jason.
Hey, man. Quick personal note. Scott, I worked at your house quite a few years ago and replaced some doors that you had issues with.
What's your question for today?
To see what's going on a couple times, and Terry's always there. She's like, no, Scott's he's in D.C. He's kind of busy.
And Jason,
well,
what's your question for today?
Jason?
Thank you very much, but I have to say, I typically lean more towards the Democratic side of things, but I honestly have supported you 100% because you are one of the very few politicians who is true to principles instead of true to people, and it is so enlightening to see what you have done and everything you have to say along the way about where you stand and why that's your position. And I'm sad to see you leaving, but I'm right there with you. Gary Johnson is who I'm going to be supporting. I cannot get behind either of the other two candidates. They are just ridiculous. And I really appreciate everything you've done, and thank you so much for your service.
Well, you know, I really appreciate hearing this. And, you know, I'd like to think that I could totally distance myself from all the really harsh things that are, I try not to, in fact, I did deactivate, I'm probably one day going to deactivate my personal page. May not be a bad thing. You'd have one less fan though, Kathy. That's the only problem.
Yeah, I can't have that happen. Really.
But when I hear things like have been said on the program, and I know I'm sure there's some listeners who could call in and give another view of that in my service. But that said, it is good to hear, and it's encouraging, and I appreciate it.
Thank you for the call, Jason. I appreciate it. We have about a minute and a half left, Congressman, and I wonder what your next plan is. I mean, I'm sure you've had lots of ideas that have been kicking around in your head. I know you're concerned about civil discourse, and we've had so many good conversations about that. What's next for you?
Well, for the first time in my life, and I've been working at home since about the age of 12, and bussing tables and washing dishes since 15, worked all through high school and college part-time, and I'm 50, so I'll be 56. And I know this, for the first time, I'm at peace with just catching my breath.
I can appreciate
and
that.
Thinking. I want to think a little bit about what's happening to our country, and I'm not being coy about this. It's no political plan or anything like that. I just really want to think. But I do know that it's good to be productive. I trust and hope and pray a number of good years left to contribute and use what I've learned and experienced in a constructive way. So I do want to help. I love being around young people, helping them to be to reject apathy and to believe in our future and to fight for our future. So there'll be some expression of that, I think, along the way. And I always appreciate you having me on the show and the opportunity to connect with your listeners and you as well.
Thank you. Appreciate it as well, Congressman. You've been a good friend of this broadcast, and I'm very appreciative. In fact, you're the one I always hold up when I hear people say, well, we can't be on that show. I think to myself, my goodness, we have everybody comes on this show. So why would you not want to do
right.
that?
I think, well, I appreciate it. I think we need more discussion. And once you start talking to the folks on the other side, you realize, wait a minute, they love America and they love their families, and sometimes just a difference in how we're going to go about these policies. But I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, we look forward to having you back. And as you think through that process, I hope you'll keep us in mind and share that along the way.
Sure.
Congressman Scott Ridgel, thanks so much for being with us today. Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Take care. And we will be back in just a moment with a conversation with Senator Tim Kaine from the Vice Presidential Campaign Trail. Glad to have Senator Tim Kaine with us. Now, I think you were last with us in December. Anything been going on since then you want to share?
It's been a surreal last couple of months. You know, I was asked to join the Democratic ticket with Hillary Clinton on July 22nd at 7:32 p.m. Not that it was a memorable moment, but it's been very exciting. I'm thrilled to be on the ticket. Hillary is an amazing public servant with a real track record of empowering families with kids. And she chose me because I have some modest charms, but also, Kathy, I got to tell you, a lot of the reason she chose me was because Virginia's important. And I love the fact that Virginia has moved from, you know, irrelevant in presidential years to now very relevant. And that was part of it. And I'm proud that our state is kind of in the spotlight.
Yeah. And it has been for a little while now. And you've been going all over the country, a little more than 6 weeks away from this election. The polls seem to suggest that most voters are concerned about jobs in the economy and security here at home. And I wonder, that's what the polls say. Is
Absolutely.
That what you're hearing on the campaign trail?
I think so. Yeah. The whole issue of how do we take an economy that is growing, thank goodness, 15 million private sector jobs, unemployment rate cut in half from the depths of the recession, but people still have to perceive that they have their own ladder to success. And in some communities, we just need more. So Hillary and I, that's the first platform of our campaign, an economy that works for everybody, not just those at the top, not winner take all or dog eat dog, but an economy that works for everybody. And then the second point that you raise is also critically important. What's the best way for America to be safe? And obviously, in Virginia, this matters so deeply to us. I have a child in the military. It's very personal to me. We want to make sure that our military is strong, but we also know that in a world where, you know, somebody can travel here or there, it's also about strong alliances and sharing intelligence and working together with other nations to stop terrorism. So those are the two main goals. And there are plenty of other issues, too. Do you believe in climate science or don't you? Do you believe in LGBT equality or don't you? Do you think voting should be easier, or do you want to put burdens in people's way to vote? So there's plenty of issues, but the economy and our safety are the top two.
So as we think about the economy, you note that some people are feeling like they've been left behind in this process, and they're concerned about that because their incomes have not returned to the pre-recession level. So what would a Clinton Kaine administration do to address those people specifically who do feel left behind?
Well, a couple of things. In the first 100 days of the administration, we're going to put the biggest job expansion plan on the table that's been done since World War II, and it has a couple of components. The first is sizable investments, especially in infrastructure, research, and manufacturing, and I'll really focus on infrastructure. Hampton Roads knows this well, whether it's road or rail or the port. All over Virginia, we have infrastructure needs, and this is the case around the country, and it's a great time to do infrastructure investments. Interest rates are low. You put people to work, but then when you make these investments, you live off them for 40 or 50 years, whether it's, you know, road, rail, transportation investments or clean energy investments or broadband deployment. You raise your platform for economic success. So that's the first component of the plan. The second component is really focusing on skills, education from pre-K to college affordability to career and technical and apprenticeship programs like the Newport News Shipbuilding Program. We want to make sure that all of our workers, whether they're young students or people in the middle of their careers, have the ability to get the skills they need to be successful. Third, we want to do some fairness things, minimum wage, equal pay for equal work, paid family leave. And then finally, the fourth pillar of our economic plan is to really focus on small businesses. Hillary and I know this is where the job growth comes in our country. We both We're up in small business households. And so those four components are the components that we think are necessary to create an economy that works for everybody.
And I know in your past conversations with us, you've talked about talent acquisition, how critically important that is, and
yes.
the role of college debt, which, as you know, is just growing. And there have been conversations about making college debt-free and doing something for those who already have
yes.
loans. And the question is, what does that mm-hmm. look like, and how would we pay for that? Because it's a pretty big number.
It is a big number, but you know, it is interesting, Kathy. Other nations do it. They make college debt free or even free because they recognize, just like we make K-12 education, public education free, because boy, that's just something that you ought to have a successful life. Other nations realize that you need skills beyond high school to be successful. So there are basically three components to the plan, and you've set them out correctly. The first one is to make college debt-free, just make a commitment that we're going to do that, and that'll have a cost. And then phase two would be to allow families that make less than $125,000 even to have tuition, in-state tuition free. We're going to finance this particular part of the plan like we're going to finance the other investments in infrastructure, et cetera, which is we're not going to do anything in the tax code or tax rates for people who make less than $250,000. We're going to provide some tax relief around child care and other important incentives. We're going to provide some tax relief for small businesses. But for the very wealthiest, the largest businesses, financial institutions, who have done very, very well as we've come out of the recession, we're going to ask them to pay more, and then we're going to plow that money back into these education and infrastructure investments. And if we do that, the entire society will benefit. And so HillaryClinton.com online, we talk about the plans, but we also talk about how we'll pay for them. The third piece that you mentioned is not so much a pay for, it's how to refinance debt. There's just laws in place that make it very, very difficult to refinance student loan debt. It's kind of odd. You can refinance a loan on a yacht or a vacation easier than a student loan. And we need to clear burdens out of the way to allow those with debt to refinance so that they can better afford this huge burden. Student loan debt is now more sizable than credit card debt in this country.
Senator Tim Kaine joining us. He's the Democratic candidate for vice president, which you probably already know, with the Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. We're talking with him a little bit today as he's on the campaign trail heading to another stop in what has become a very, very busy life. If we can look internationally, there's so much to talk about there. We had just these bombings in New York and New Jersey last week, and that sort of renewed focused attention on these lone wolves, these radicalized folks, folks who mm-hmm. are who, and then ISIS as a sort of a related issue. That is such a different world that we live in now than it was when we had sort of state actors that you had to be concerned about.
Indeed.
Where do you see what do you see a Clinton-Kaine administration doing to respond to what is a very different battleground now?
Kathy, you're right. It's very different. And I'll tell you, Hillary and I both have had searing experiences in this regard. Hillary was the senator from New York on 9/11 and was there at the World Trade Center in the aftermath as they were still searching for victims, searching for bodies. That was a searing experience for her. She was also a part of President Obama's national security team that revived the hunt to find bin Laden and wipe him out. So this is an issue she knows very, very well. And as a member of the Armed Services Committee with a child in the military, this is also something I spend a lot of time on. So two things. There's two kinds of battles that are necessary to defeat ISIS or to defeat terrorism. There is the battle that takes place on the battlefield. So right now, as you know, the U.S. has troops working with the Iraqi military, the Kurdish Peshmerga, their fighting unit, Syrian opposition, to defeat ISIL on the battleground in Iraq and Syria. And we're making progress in that fight. The ISIL territory, which was at its maximum in August of 2014, has dramatically shrunk. They realize that their days are numbered on the battlefield. But that creates the second challenge. The more they realize that, the more they are trying to strike out or radicalize people or engage in an attack in a European city or maybe in the United States. You can't really stop that militarily. You have to stop it with sharing intelligence and working with allies. And so that's the most important thing in this battle against terrorism is, you know, working with Silicon Valley to help us find folks online who are engaging in radicalizing activities, but also sharing the intelligence with allies to stop lone wolves or stop people from traveling here and there. And that's something Hillary, as a Secretary of State, deeply understands. You've got to have strong alliances. You can't say, well, we don't need NATO anymore, and we'll get rid of alliances, and then expect your intelligence sharing to be good. If you get rid of alliances, that sharing decreases. So Hillary's work as a diplomat really is important as we focus on strengthening the alliances necessary to reduce the risk of these lone wolf attacks.
You know, it strikes me there's a place where these domestic issues and these international issues sort of intersect. There's at least one place where that happens, and that's around healthcare. You know, we've got about 17% of people doing unpaid caregiving for an adult in their home. We have 11,000 baby boomers becoming eligible for Medicare every day. And, of course, we've got these warfighters coming back with the effects of traumatic brain injury. So all of that will be a stress on the healthcare system. And so what would a Clinton Kaine administration do about sort of both sides of that equation, the services needed in this new world and the money it'll take to pay for them?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. You're right. These issues do connect. Let me talk about the civilian side. Let me talk about the veteran side. You know, on the civilian side, Hillary and I are really committed. And this is a difference. We're committed to maintaining the Affordable Care Act, which has driven our uninsured rate down to the lowest it's been in, you know, 50 years. And provides health insurance for between 50 and 20 million people who didn't have it before. So we have to maintain that. The other ticket, Donald Trump says he wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act. We don't want to go backward. We want to maintain what we have and make it better. And so there are some strategies that we want to engage in to improve the Affordable Care Act, largely around making the tax credit easier to assess for the businesses that buy health insurance for their employees, and to help individuals co-payments and deductibles. That's something that we really are focused on. But we have to maintain what we have, and we can't go backward on that. Second, you point out the caregiver problem. I mean, you know, we're dealing with this in our own lives with parents, with other relatives. Just about every American family does that. And so we do want to provide some financial incentive for family caregiving, and that is in a tax credit that would enable people to benefit if they are engaged significantly in caring. And we also want to give employees the ability to take family leave. Most nations have this to care for a sick relative. We don't have it, and that is an important part of our platform. When you get on to the veteran side, look, we owe this obligation to our veterans. Many, many veterans, especially in Iraq and Afghan war era, are going to have long-term medical needs. The repeated deployment phenomenon, which is sort of new, that wasn't necessarily the case in all earlier conflicts. This is something that's going to have a long set of consequences, and we need to be there for our veterans. We've made some improvements in the VA to take care of this, you know, growing demand by allowing the veterans, if they are living far away from VA facilities or if they're in areas where VA facilities are backed up, to access private healthcare practitioners, with the VA then paying for that. But I think there's much more work to do, both around prompt scheduling of appointments and also making sure that when veterans apply for a disability benefit, it doesn't take them so long to get it. And as you know, because you covered the story about the Hampton VA, had some of the worst waiting times in the nation for medical appointments. But in the last year, last 18 months, they've done a pretty dramatic job and brought those waiting times down. But Hillary and I know that there's much more work to do.
Senator Kaine, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I know that your life has changed enormously. Interesting article in the Richmond Times-Dispatch about your wife, Secretary Holton's trip to the grocery store, and sort of what a changed experience that is. So I hope we'll get you back in the course of the campaign to talk about some other issues, and we wish you a safe travels on the campaign trail. Talk soon. Bye-bye. 10 minutes before the hour, just a few closing comments on tonight's presidential debate. We are closing in on the first presidential debate, and we know this because there's actually a countdown clock on CNN. Listen to CNN's promotional announcement for tonight's debate. And while you're at it, feel free to substitute the names of any two NFL teams or two prize fighters, and you'll see what I mean.
He is unqualified to be president.
Hillary Clinton lacks the judgment.
The scams, the frauds.
Hillary Clinton has evaded justice.
He clearly has something to hide.
Her conduct is disqualified.
Clinton, Trump, head-to-head for the first time on the same stage. The first presidential debate. Live coverage starts today at 4 on CNN.
Super Bowl much? Into this mix in the past 72 hours, we've seen cheering crowds and desks full of commentators. It would be novel to have them discuss the issues that separate these candidates or the fact that there are actually three other candidates on the ballot in addition to the two they're talking about. But just this morning, one anchor promised breathlessly that she'd be at the top of that pyramid of Hofstra cheerleaders who were right over there getting ready for the big debate. What's acknowledged as the most consequential election of our time is somewhere in this frothy mix of hype, composed of equal parts image, performance, theater, and precious little else. Again, just this morning, I heard an anchor critiquing the performance style of one of the candidates and wondering why there weren't more magical TV moments. But this election is about more than magical TV moments. It's about serious, complex, expensive issues facing this country, and we need to know what each candidate would do about them. And that's where tonight's conversation, and just about every election conversation at this point, should be focused. Much has been lamented about moderators in this cycle, and that's a blood sport that goes back further than the 2016 campaign. I think you'd be hard-pressed to recall the last time somebody said, you know, that moderator did a really good job. Few emerge in glory. But I'm sympathetic to moderators for a couple of reasons. First, I think it's actually the candidate's obligation to fact-check and tell the truth. I kind of like the idea of a team of real-time fact-checkers putting message crawls on the bottom of the screen when a candidate is incorrect or when their present statement conflicts with their past. But to expect a moderator to play that role without fail is a bridge too far. Lester Holt is one of the best in the business, and if he slips up and doesn't call out one of the candidates on something, it's probably not because he has an agenda. It's because it's live TV, and there's a lot going on. But if the system is going to change, we need to be the ones to change it. And so at the risk of sounding cranky, I will humbly offer five quick ideas for tonight's debate consumption. First, turn off the TV or the radio until the debate itself, which starts at 9 o'clock. Except if you're listening to public broadcasting, that's a whole different thing. The pre-show on CNN starts 5 hours earlier at 4 o'clock, and it's been going on throughout the weekend. Turn the TV off when Lester Holt says it's over. Think about what you've heard and make up your own mind. Don't be distracted by commentators trying to nail down amorphous momentum. Third, while there's been lots of temptation to drink during the campaign, try to resist drinking games. I know, I sound like your mother, right? Drinking games just trivialize the whole exercise. Why not try to have an actual conversation about what you've heard that mattered and what you'd like to hear? And in your conversations about the debate tomorrow, resist the urge, and it's powerful, to comment on the style of the debate. Focus your conversation instead on the substance. Believe me, it'll be a lot shorter conversation. Style doesn't matter. Substance does. There are real policy issues that separate all five candidates, and we've allowed ourselves to get distracted by silliness. But we are 6 weeks away from the election, and it's past time to get serious. Public Broadcasting's coverage of the presidential debate begins at 9 o'clock on WHRO TV 15, and right here, of course, on 89.5 WHRV as well. So we do hope you will tune in for it, because this will be the first of the presidential debates. Then there's a vice presidential debate in October, which will be coming to you from the campus of Longwood University. So we are in the final stretch of this campaign, and there is a lot going on. We'll do our best to keep you up to date on all of the goings on. And we should also note that every week until the election, on this broadcast, we are taking a look at some issue of the presidential campaign and taking a look at the candidates' positions on that. We've already talked a bit about national security. We have also talked a bit about immigration. Tomorrow we'll be talking about tonight's debate, which will be last night when we get to it. So we'll talk about that tomorrow. And we have many, many more issues coming at you in the weeks leading up to the election. Up next right here on 89.5, it is Making Contact. And then again, coming up tonight on WHRO TV 15, 8 o'clock, it's the Antiques Roadshow, saluting the presidential election and examining keepsakes from former political battles. And then at 9 o'clock, it's the PBS NewsHour debate that's going to be covering tonight's 2016 presidential debate, as we said. And so again, that's going to be a 90-minute debate, and there will be a half an hour of commentary after that on public radio and public television. I myself am going to turn it off when Lester says it's done, just because I want to think about it a little bit. At any rate, hope you're having a great day, and we will see you right back here tomorrow. So do watch the debate tonight and come on back tomorrow and we'll talk about it. See if you changed your mind. There are still some undecided voters out there, and tonight's debate is one where they may see or hear something that will help them make a decision about how they'll cast their votes on November 8th. So what we will do is find out if you are one of those undecided voters tomorrow. We'll find out from you whether you heard anything in tonight's debate that will change your mind. But again, it's coming up tonight at 9 right here on 89.5 WHRV. This is the CNN debate, the first of three. It'll also air on WHRO TV 15. Thanks so much for listening today, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow.